From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June in Pasadena, California, at an event called Politicon, a self-described unconventional political convention. The New Yorker magazine picks up the story of Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson, who gave a speech at that event. Then Johnson walked around the convention giving interviews, and I will quote from the magazine now. One reporter asked Johnson about the lack of diversity in the Libertarian Party, which, as some people remember from college dorm room discussions, tends to attract a disproportionate number of young white males. Johnson said that there was no diversity problem and that the party would do better in non-white communities as he became better known. A few minutes later, an aide directed him to a room in the convention center that was named for Harriet Tubman. "Who's Harriet Tubman?" Johnson asked. After the aide reminded him who Tubman was, Johnson recalled that, oh yes, she will appear on a new $20 bill. End quote from the magazine. But while Johnson's lack of familiarity with Harriet Tubman provoked some opprobrium online, polls show many Americans don't know much, or really anything, about Harriet Tubman. Is that a failure of our educational system? And speaking of education, viewers who watched Michelle Obama speak at the Democratic National Convention learned a bit of history when Michelle Obama talked about the White House's origins. Here's what the First Lady said that night.
That is the story of this country. The story that has brought me to this stage tonight. The story of generations of people who felt the lash of bondage, the shame of servitude, the sting of segregation, but who kept on striving and hoping and doing what needed to be done so that today I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. My daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
The next night on Fox News, Bill O'Reilly replayed those remarks and then offered his own kind of history lesson. Here's what Bill O'Reilly said.
In 1800, President John Adams took up residence in what was then called the Executive Mansion. It was only later on they named it the White House. But Adams was in there with Abigail, and they were still hammering nails. The construction was still going on. Slaves that worked there were well fed and had decent lodgings provided by the government, which stopped hiring slave labor in 1802. However, the feds did not forbid subcontractors from using slave labor. So Michelle Obama is essentially correct in citing slaves as builders of the White House, but there were others working as well.
Did you catch the interjection of the slaves being well-fed with decent lodgings? As you might imagine, that brought a backlash, and many people wondered why O'Reilly felt the need to include the idea that the slaves were well-fed. The implication was that, well, you know, slavery wasn't as rough as you might think. The food was pretty good. The next night, O'Reilly fired back at his critics, claiming he only wanted to present the full historical record.
In order to keep slaves and free laborers strong, the Washington administration provided meat, bread, and other staples, also decent lodging on the grounds of the new presidential building. That is a fact, not a justification, not a defense of slavery, just a fact. Anyone who implies a soft on slavery message is beneath contempt.
All of which leads us to our conversation this hour, from the construction of the White House to Harriet Tubman. What are we teaching our children? What are our educational priorities? What should they be? Let me welcome our guests for the hour. Honored to have alongside us in studio Geraldine Copes Daniels, who is the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also here is Benjamin Lawrence, Professor of International Studies and Director of International and Global Studies at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Benjamin, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
In studio is Maggie Moore Holly. She is a Harriet Tubman reenactor. Great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And on the phone with us is Catherine Clinton, Chair of the American History Department at the University of Texas in San Antonio and International Research Professor of History at Queen's University Belfast. Catherine, thank you for taking the time for the program.
Surely. Thanks.
I want to start in studio here with Geraldine Copes Daniels, who is the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. And it was in April that the U.S. government announced that Harriet Tubman was the woman chosen to be on the $20 bill, the first woman on American currency. What did that mean to you?
It means to me that this woman is one of the greatest women there is in this world. She has done so much for all of us, and that we're not really giving her the credit that she's supposed to have. But we love her.
She's an American hero.
Yes, she is.
She is an American hero in so many, many ways. And I wonder, Geraldine, do you think that Harriet Tubman's story is taught enough? The fullness of her story, is it taught in American schools?
No, I don't think it's gone that far. But I do have a brand new book that has come out. And it's all in there.
Well, I think what's interesting is since that decision to put her on the 20, the first of all, polls indicate that a majority of Americans are happy with that decision, but a lot of Americans will also say to pollsters that they don't fully understand her story. Not that they oppose it, they just want to learn more. And I wonder, Maggie Moore-Holly, who is a Harriet Tubman reenactor since about 2010, is that right?
Correct.
And you do reenactment where?
All over the city, wherever I'm requested.
Wherever they want you.
Wherever they want me.
What are people learning when you are out participating in some of these reenactments? Do you feel like the audience is learning a story largely for the first time?
Yes. Especially the essence of the woman, Harriet. We've been introduced to Harriet in children's books. And it gives a little insight into what she said, some of the things that she said, even though I don't think that what it was being written then was really her voice. So when I decided to study Harriet, I had to search for material. And then as I was searching, you know, I found some really important information about her. But as far as the knowledge that people have of her, I think it's very, very, very slim.
Let's ask Catherine Clinton why that may be the case. Again, the chair of the American History Department at the University of Texas in San Antonio, someone who knows a great deal about this subject. Is it too scant, the coverage of this great American hero, this woman, Catherine?
Well, absolutely. I was teaching at Harvard University, and I was asked to do an article on her for an encyclopedia. And when I began to look into it in the 1990s, I found no serious academic work on the project of her life. I found that there had only been two biographies, one published by one of her contemporaries and another by a journalist published in 1943, and although there were literally scores of children's book in print, some by very respectable, wonderful authors like Dorothy Sterling, I was concerned that her work was not being placed within the context of American history. Not only her work on the Underground Railroad, but her really, truly unique and singular contribution to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So she was someone who I thought was being treated like a folkloric figure when I began my work. Luckily, in the 21st century, I think this is very much being addressed. There have been a handful of biographies out on her, and of course the campaign to educate the public about this new important step of the first woman on the currency has resulted in a lot of press, and I hope will be continuing to be part of the scholarship that will insert her into the larger picture of American women, of American heroes, and certainly people who have made our country what it is today.
A lot was made in April after the selection of Harriet Tubman for the $20 bill about the fact that the Google searches for Harriet Tubman exploded. And the implication was people just didn't know anything about her. I'm not sure that's true. I might have been one of those people, because I think what I wanted to do was sort of reacquaint myself not only with the broader stories, as you say, Catherine, that are almost folkloric and less human, but I wanted to learn more about the human. And so what I want to do is ask our panel, as best they can, you're not going to get the Harriet Tubman full biography this hour. We can't do that. But what do we need to know as a baseline? And then on the human side, what should we know? I'll start with you, Catherine. You know, this is we call her an American hero. She is an American hero. What should we know about Harriet Tubman?
Well, I think that she, the lesson that she taught to many school children, which needs to be learned, was that she was someone who had great faith. She was someone who was a great believer in freedom and bringing freedom to others. She made sacrifices. She was truly brave and intrepid and all of those things. She brought families out of freedom. She was an abductor, meaning she went into the slave South at risk to herself and brought people out. She was also someone who was well known at the time. She had to use a pseudonym when she spoke out in Boston at abolitionist rallies. But more important, the Underground Railroad, which has so defined her legacy today, is only part of it. After the Civil War, she settled in Auburn, New York, where she had bought a home, and she began to gather money for education. She spent her life illiterate, but she was very committed to Black education, and she was known as a philanthropist in her town because women's suffrage, taking care of the poor, establishing her own charity home meant that she was so remarkable and revered. But as an historian, I'm also struck by the fact that when one of her biographers wrote to a descendant of William Lloyd Garrison and asked about Harriet Tubman in the 1930s, he said, "Who?" And so indeed, history is full of cycles, and it's important in the 21st century that, as Michelle Obama reminds us, we have to go back into our history and fully understand who built America. And Harriet Tubman was one of those great builders and liberators.
And by the way, Catherine, before I turn to the panel in studio, I will just ask you as well. You know, given Rochester's connection to Susan B. Anthony, it was understandable that many Rochesterians had a bit of a hope for Susan B. Anthony on a piece of currency, though I don't think anybody that I know who was supporting Susan B. Anthony is wringing their hands over Harriet Tubman. I think there's a lot of satisfaction with that choice. And I think then the broader question is this, or at least I think a statement is, this shouldn't be viewed as, well, you got your piece of currency. You know, that's enough. I wonder how you feel about this, not just the decision of Harriet Tubman, but the question of sort of putting women as well as men on currency and where this goes next and what this does mean.
Well, there was a lot of controversy, I know, and it was viewed as a contest, I think, because it started out as a grassroots campaign, mm-hmm. Women on the 20s. And indeed, the Treasury came back with the new 10 because the $10 bill is due for redesign. But it does show the power of the public and the power of voices and the importance of speaking out, because it was women all across America and men who joined in this campaign and said, when are we at long last going to recognize the contribution of the builders of the nation? And I think 2016 is a really good year to have that debate. It's overdue, but nevertheless very important. And it also got a wider discussion of the many important women. Over 1 million people wrote into the Treasury with their candidates. And yet, in this political year, when the one of the first early debates, many of the candidates in the Republican Party were flummoxed by what woman might appear on the currency. I mean, I think it shows a definite deficit that we have to really think hard and long about the way in which women have contributed. And then Harriet Tubman rose to the top of many lists, that Harriet Tubman was considered by the Secretary of the Treasury as someone significant, I think shows us that there are many more women that we don't know about. I mean, I've written 5 biographies in the past few decades, and Harriet Tubman was one of the most rewarding, but there are plenty of women out there that we need to go and find out about them. I think the rediscovery of Shirley Chisholm's run for president is another important era, and she, I think, is someone who harkened back to Harriet Tubman and her achievements.
We had a listener already asking if there was any concern that Harriet Tubman on the 20 would get rescinded in some way, and I think the answer to that is no. Politico reports that Iowa Republican Representative Steve King had proposed a congressional challenge to putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. He said, quote, "It's not about Harriet Tubman. It's about keeping the picture on the 20 of Andrew Jackson. You know, why would you want to change that?" This is King's line. "I'm a conservative. I like to keep what we have." He called the push for Harriet Tubman divisive, while his amendment to keep her off the bill is unifying. He says, quote, "because it says just don't change anything," end quote. But I think that was ultimately defeated. So to answer that listener's question, I think we are going to see Harriet Tubman eventually on the $20 bill, despite that effort. And I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation about any of these matters as we go throughout this hour, you can do that. It's toll free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In a second, I'm going to ask Benjamin Lawrence about some of the parallels he sees between Tubman's life and some of what he has written about and covered in more modern times as well. And we're also going to talk about what you heard off the top of the hour about Michelle Obama's comments, Bill O'Reilly, and more. But let me stick with this for just one second. Maggie Moore Holly, who is a Harriet Tubman reenactor, for you, what are the most important lessons, especially if one of your audiences, you as a reenactor, comes in with very little knowledge of Harriet Tubman? What's vital that they take away from you?
I would say her faith, as well as her courage. But I think her faith is what gave her courage. She didn't worry about what would happen to her in her quest to free others. And not only that, she believes in family. I believe that her quest to go back into a system that was totally dangerous for a woman and basically walking and hiding at the same time, the courage to go back into that system to retrieve someone was the most courageous thing that I've ever heard of. Once you're free, it seems almost unbelievable to go back.
And you couldn't blame someone, could you?
No.
I mean, when I think, Maggie, I think, I mean, I'll never be able, trust me, as a white male, I'll never be able to understand the mentality and the fear and the challenge. But I just have to think, if I were ever in a position of finally achieving freedom when I didn't have freedom, I don't know that I'd have the courage to go back.
But
and I wouldn't blame people who
did. One of her statements was that the reason she went back, because even though she was free, she was alone. She didn't have her family with her. And that's an important thing to know, that even in slavery, there were still family ties. Even though on some plantations, families were separated. But with her, there was a family connection that was not to be broken. And so she risked her life in order to go back and bring her family out. Time after time after time.
By the way, is it emotional for you to reenact with this? Yeah?
Yes, absolutely. Because with a courage as great as that people do not know about, it's unbelievable. And being a woman and a black woman, not even during that era, I understand the struggle, the challenge, and just the danger in the stand that she took even during that time.
Let me turn to Geraldine Copes Daniels, great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. I think you've heard a couple of people in our panel commenting on what they would want American students in class to know now to make sure that we're learning about Harriet Tubman. What would you want people to know as the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman?
I would like for them to know what she did before she was out here in the North.
Mm-hmm.
When she was in the South, she helped to save many people. She got hit in the head trying to save a young man. And that gave her some sort of sleeping sickness, and she would go to sleep without anybody realizing what she was doing. She would go right to sleep, and somebody had to be right there to make sure that she was okay. And even though she was doing this, she was bringing people back and forth through the underground. And this lady went to war, the Civil War, and she freed many people during the Civil War. She helped the soldiers blow up bridges, ammunition dumps, and many other things while she was there. This lady was a courageous woman, and she went through many a trials and tribulations trying to save her people because they had bounties out for her. They had bounty seekers mm-hmm. on horseback running back and forth, yet she did what she had to do.
Mm-hmm. She was a war hero in many ways. Let me grab a phone call from a listener who wants to weigh in on what we're teaching and where. This is Judy in Greece. Go ahead, Judy.
Hi. I was just up in Canada, and if you want to learn about Harriet Tubman, go to St. Catharines. I stayed at a bed and breakfast there, and I asked the owner about this, if this was taught in his schools. He said, oh, we're very proud of the role we had in protecting the escapees that made it to Canada, particularly mm-hmm. Harriet Tubman. He took me to downtown St. Catharines, where the church still stands where she worshiped, and in their back of the church, there's a small memory garden for her. So they do more in to recognize her in Canada than we do here in the U.S.
Wow. That's... How do you feel about that, Judy?
Oh, I was floored. I was absolutely floored.
Boy.
Well, I'd like to say in the past decade, there's been a growing movement to memorialize. There's a statue to her in Boston's South End. There's one in Battle Creek. Mm-hmm. I recently viewed one in Little Rock. That all across the country, I think there has been a revival of interest. And indeed, she was taught because Ontario was a region that she returned to again and again, bringing people out to freedom under the lion's paw, as she called it. But I do think now that there has been an awareness of her contribution, and we are trying to put her into the public sphere in a way that she hasn't been before. Of course, we as historians are caught up in a lot of battlegrounds involving memorialization, statues, who deserves a statue, where, mm-hmm. why. But certainly Tubman is someone who we can agree had a very central role in the underground movement, was important, but I recently was aware that there was a movement to put her on a mural in Baltimore, for example, but she would have been in that mural, the artist depicted her as holding a gun. So I write in my book about how the issue of guns and violence and taking a stand all overlayer into our public discussions about memorialization.
Let me turn to Benjamin Lawrence, who's a professor of international studies and director of the International and Global Studies Program at Rochester Institute of Technology. And Benjamin, we have talked about your work looking at sort of contemporary slavery, human trafficking. And I wonder, when you look at Harriet Tubman, this American hero who risked so much, what are the parallels you see, and, you know, how do you view it? What's the historical context you see her in?
Well, that's a great question, because Harriet Tubman really is a remarkable figure for so many reasons. But in what I think about routinely is how many times she came back to rescue others. And that says perhaps more than anything else to me about what sort of person she must have been inside in terms of her personal integrity. Today, we recognize that being a slave is a violation of a fundamental human right, and slavery is illegal around the world. So it troubles me when people like Bill O'Reilly or the congressman from Iowa sort of position a debate around someone as a human rights defender as if it's a left-right debate. This is not about left and right. These people, and particularly someone like Harriet Tubman, is a human rights defender of the first order. She's a remarkable person. So most stories of people fleeing slavery and actually getting out of the South, whether it was the border states like Maryland or Deep South, which is, of course, harder to do, most of these people never came back, right? And we know that some of them were kidnapped in the North. There are people even kidnapped out of Canada and brought into slavery again. Mm-hmm. Most people who escaped never looked back. And I think most people who flee a burning building never look back. How many people run into a burning building to rescue somebody else who's still there? It's an extraordinary idea. But to go back again and again and again, think of the way we celebrate firemen and firewomen who do that work. I mean, they are our heroes. Mm-hmm. This woman was a remarkable hero. She went back dozens and dozens of times and took people and smuggled them over hundreds and hundreds of miles into a place, knowing all the while then not only could she herself be enslaved, but she could be killed.
And I understand the fireman metaphor, but it would be even more apt if our firefighters today were people who grew up living in burning houses.
There you go.
And then eventually didn't live in a burning house anymore and then went back to fight fire.
She escaped slavery, and escaping slavery was a remarkable thing. Not many slaves escaped slavery. Most people remained in slavery. The majority of American slaves were liberated when slavery was ended by change in the Constitution and the end of the Civil War. So she is in a class of her own in terms of the type of people. So in my book, Amistad's Orphans, I talk about one young African, probably African-born slave. He was the ship's boy on the Amistad, and he chooses, he makes his own choice to escape out of New York from Connecticut via New York and then up through New York, through Albany, up into Vermont and eventually into Quebec. And we know that he passed from home to home, and these individual conductors on the railroad would help people for certain stages of the way, right? They would work from, say, Albany to Saratoga, or Burlington to the border, or something like that, right? And they worked within the physical space that they knew, the passage that they knew. They knew homes that they could stay in, places they could hide someone under a bridge if something happened, right? Very few people worked all the way up and down the Underground Railroad, right? That is a remarkable idea, because you're putting yourself in constant jeopardy every stage that you you move somebody. So, and not only did she do that, but she did it multiple times, time and time again. And I think, I mean, who are we to really speculate what was in her mind? But I think, like a lot of human rights activists today, she believed that she was not free until everybody was free, mm-hmm. right? She really felt strongly that slavery is not just a personal condition, but it's a human condition. And when slavery exists in the world, we are all worse for it, right?
Absolutely right. And you talk about it not being partisan. I hate to do this, but I'm looking at a survey right here. 81% of Democrats support putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. 50% of independents, 34% of Republicans.
It's shocking.
And you know how I feel about this? What is going on here?
This is not a conservative issue.
It should not be a conservative issue. Listeners, if you are a conservative or you consider yourself a Republican, this survey indicates that you probably don't want Harriet Tubman on the 20. I want you to call this program right now and tell me why. And I don't mean to be emotional or fired up, but I don't understand it. And I want to hear from you. And I want to listen, by the way. I'm going to try to be really open-minded and listen. I'd love to hear from you. Call 844-295-TALK. I suppose we probably won't get anybody to call, but maybe we will. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Benjamin, you want to add something?
You know, there? I tweeted, like many historians did, Bill O'Reilly when he said these things. He was wrong on so many levels, but he was particularly wrong.
Hold on, back it up. You're talking about Benjamin's referencing. Well, maybe let's do this, because I'm way late for break. Let's take our only break. We're going to come back. If you're on the phone, Gail and Henrietta, we're going to get to you. Other callers, we'll get to you. Benjamin's referencing what Bill O'Reilly said about slaves and the conditions in which they lived and worked after Michelle Obama's remarks about the White House being built by slaves. So let's get our only break. We'll come back. We'll pick it up there, because I know you tried to get Mr. O'Reilly's attention. We'll see. Benjamin will tell us how that went and his thoughts about that. And we'll continue with our panel here. Benjamin is here from RIT. He's a professor of international studies and director of international and global studies at RIT. Maggie Moore Holly is here, a Harriet Tubman reenactor. Geraldine Copes Daniels here, the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. And on the line with us is Catherine Clinton, chair of the American History Department at the University of Texas in San Antonio and an international research professor of history at Queen's University Belfast. Right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, murder on screen can get you a PG-13 rating in Hollywood, but smoke one joint and it's almost always rated R. Language, well, that's variable. How about relationships? You can show plenty of sex and still be rated PG-13, but one same-sex relationship, even without sex, is almost always rated R. Discrepancies at the movies next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Michelle Obama's speech at the Democratic National Convention was praised by just about everybody I saw, with the exception of some Twitter eggs. And you know, she had that line about the White House being built by slaves. The reason I think that line got the applause it did, John Oliver ribbed the audience a little for that, saying you don't applaud that. But I think the point was people were applauding the fact that someone is saying it. Someone is recognizing history. Someone is not trying to whitewash history. And it was powerful. Of course, Bill O'Reilly the next night said, well, yes, it's true. And here's a little bit more history. And he mentioned, and the slaves there were well-fed and well had good lodging. You know, as if anybody had asked about what they were eating. And Benjamin Lawrence, I know for a number of reasons this really moved you. In fact, you jumped right online to kind of respond. But start with what offended you first, right out of the gate.
Well, first of all, it's not true that they were well-fed and well-housed, right? They were rented slaves. And in many cases, rented slaves are the bottom of the pack, right? Mm. When you rent a slave, you are working that person for a payment that you're making to the slave owner. So you are less interested in ensuring their welfare, their food, their clothing, their housing. That is generally the burden of the slave owner. So the idea, and we know from Abigail Adams' letters and we know from other documents that rented slaves, whether they worked on the White House or the Capitol building, which was also built by slaves, or other contexts of slave renting, they were worse off routinely than slaves who worked directly for a slave master on a plantation or in other settings. So that's just simply wrong. If anybody was well-fed or well-housed, I would like to see the documentation. And of course, he hasn't been able to produce that despite requests. But what troubled me secondly, was the idea that he felt he needed to editorialize and explain, interpret Michelle Obama. This woman is living in the house. She is a very highly educated woman. She has read well. She has studied. She knows exactly what she's talking about. And the idea that someone takes somebody else's narrative and feels that they need to add to it and explain it is deeply troubling. I find it misogynistic. And sort of coded in a very racialized way. It's also a missed opportunity for Bill O'Reilly because he could have used this opportunity to really talk about the legacy of slaves in making America great, building the country that we love and live in. Instead, he uses an opportunity to, I think the phrase he used later on was left-wing nuts or wing nuts or left-wing loonies. You know, he called people who critiqued him left-wing. This is not a left-right issue. This is slavery versus freedom, right? This is the employment of slaves and their experience. We know that Harriet Tubman was injured when you were a slave. I tweeted him, I said, yeah, and I'm sure the whips were made of velvet, right? I mean, what's the sort of narrative, and I want to connect to Catherine Clinton's phrase, folkloric. What this says to me is it really speaks to the folkloric way in the United States we talk about slavery, right? We're not really interested in actually learning the lived experience in case it somehow offends us or troubles us or makes us uncomfortable about the trauma that slaves experienced, right? And that's what folklore does. It sort of makes it benign and like Robin Hood narratives, right? They're playful and fun. Harriet Tubman is not a folklore, and slavery was not a folkloric experience.
Well, and let me just say, I promised that I would listen if someone wanted to call and dissent about the idea of Harriet Tubman on the 20. And so let me take a couple of phone calls. Kim in Rochester. Go ahead, Kim.
Hi. Just to get this clear, I read about her as a child and thought she was a remarkable, inspiring woman. But I think they should come up with a $3 bill, a new bill. It would be highly collectible. It would be, you know, a bill of her own, not just, you know, oh, let's put her on the 20 or let's put her on the 10 or let's put her on. So that's my thought there.
Okay, hold on, though, Kim.
I think she's as remarkable as Eleanor Roosevelt and other strong women that have done so many things. It's not against Harriet Tubman. I just think she deserved her own bill.
Okay, but
well, by putting her on the $20 bill, which is the most commonly circulating bill, it is also a bill that circulates internationally. Large percentages of American currency are used abroad. Mm-hmm. And by having a well-circulating, well-used American bill with an American woman on it sends an important message. There, of course, were discussions about other bills and which bill and who would be replaced. But as Secretary Liu said, it is a new set of bills that are going to portray America as a country seeking freedom. And Harriet Tubman will be on the front of the 20, but I'd like to point out there will be women suffragists, including Sojourner Truth, on the reverse side of the $10 bill, and there will be Marian Anderson on the $5 bill at the Lincoln Memorial. So this is a real sea change, and it's important to say it's not a matter of, quote, real estate, but it's a matter of, indeed, telling more stories and doing it in the way of getting your message out, widely circulating.
Kim, are you feeling like this is an injustice to Andrew Jackson?
Well, he's been there for a long time. He was a president.
So what?
So what?
Yeah, so what?
Well, so what then? So buttons. I just think, you know, she should have had her own bill.
No, I understand. I mean, but your justification for Jackson was he's been on that bill a long time.
Right.
But there's lots of things that we do over and over again that are stupid things to do. And just because we've done them for a while doesn't mean we should keep doing them, right?
Well, he was a president.
Can I say that he was a very much reviled president by many communities?
Well,
Native Americans, for example.
I know a little bit about him, not a lot.
Yeah, Native Americans are deeply troubled by the image of Andrew Jackson because he is responsible for the mass clearances of Native communities in the South and the Southwest.
Yes.
Right. And he was a slave owner. He was a very a wealthy slave owner. I want to echo what Professor Clinton said earlier. We have to think about what is the currency? What does a currency mean? It is legal tender, and it's something that displays who we are as Americans globally. Because I just came back from Belize, where the U.S. dollar is used all the time, and I paid in $20 bills.
And who's on the U.S. dollar?
I paid in $20 bills with Andrew Jackson. I'm saying, so the image of what we circulate on our currency is also the image that we tell of our country. So something being on a bill because of tradition, the tradition argument has been invoked in all sorts of contexts in terms of not allowing interracial marriage, not allowing LGBT marriage, not allowing rights to change. The tradition argument is often invoked by conservatives as a let's leave things the way they are. But if those things don't represent who we are, then how is that fair?
And Kim, before I let you go, first of all, I want to thank you for calling. And second of all, I do understand your point that you were making initially about give her a new bill, give her her own bill. And I think that I trust, I don't know you, but I trust that's a very noble intention. Do you understand the point, though, that Benjamin's making, that Catherine was making,
yes,
about the fact that that kind of a bill, if you invent a $3 bill, not very few people are going to use that. That's not going to be used internationally. It's not going to be used the way a 20 is. And that 20 is a very symbolic statement right out of the gate, not creating a bill that very few people will use. Do you take that point?
Okay, so you want it to be circulated, but the Susan B. Anthony was on a coin. You don't see them circulated. People collect them.
You're right about that.
Money, you know, more money someday because of who's on it.
Yeah, you are right.
Well,
about
I'd like
that.
To say there's also a $2 bill. Jefferson is on it, and ironically and importantly, the $2 bill has often been used politically. That it is often used as a protest in African American communities to show their buying power. So currency does send messages. It sends messages domestically and abroad, but also it's important to see how much vitriol and how much intense debate has come out over the notion that you would actually put an American woman on an American bill on currency, and to see Congress people trying to oppose this, to see the kind of conservative backlash against it and ridicule is something that I think also shows the incivility and the tenor of the times and why we need to re-educate our young that it's important to include all the people, including those heroes who have sacrificed, who are also women.
Right.
Let me turn to the other panelists, and then we're going to get back to your phone calls because the phone has lit up here. I'll just ask Geraldine Copes Daniels, who's with us in studio, the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. What did you think? I mean, Kim is saying give her her own bill. She doesn't want to see it around the 20 for those reasons. But she says she is a great American. She respects Harriet Tubman. Did that move you at all? What did you think?
No, it didn't move me at all. But I would just like to say that by her being on the $20 bill, we have to see it first before we can say too much about it.
That's fair, too.
And we have to be fair with everyone else.
Yeah, I think that's a good reminder here. It's still a long time coming
yes.
before this. Maggie Moore-Holly is a Harriet Tubman reenactor. What do you think, Maggie?
I think when we introduce something that has been kept in the dark so long, it makes people nervous. Mm-hmm. It makes them afraid of what might become. I'd like to see her on the 20. I prayed for that she would be on the 20, so mm-hmm. that she could be recognized not only nationally, but globally. It's time for change.
Mm-hmm.
She will represent African-American women and a changing image of African-American women. I can reveal that in my forthcoming book, Stepdaughters of History, I have an anecdote about sitting on a panel on a program discussing with other historians, including the Treasurer of the United States, Rosie Rios, who was a champion of this, and also Secretary Liu, that one of the historians there made the remark, is the American public really ready to have a mammy on its money? And
sorry.
It was really an electric moment, and
my
reached into my bag to pull out my book cover to show Harriet Tubman, dignified, beautiful as she was in photographs. She, like Frederick Douglass, used photography to project a particular mm-hmm, image, and mm-hmm. she's always wearing a beautiful lace collar. She indeed, upon a time, had head coverings, but that was something when she was, of course, a working woman in the 19th century. But when I reached in my bag and pulled it out, a lot of people thought, because I was from Texas, I might have been reaching for my gun. But I don't tote a gun, but I do admire that we are going to have an image of a strong, a powerful, a woman of faith, and a woman whose faith led her to become an American hero, and putting that image on the mm-hmm. money will change not just the minds of children, but they will see her, they will know about her, they will Google her, they will learn about her in their textbooks, because it is a symbolic image. It's not really worth it when you think of how many millions of African Americans were bought, sold, and traded, but it shows the possibilities of change.
All right, back to the phones we go. In Rochester, this is Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Good afternoon. The more I listen, the more I want to comment. I have in my possession $8 coins with Sacagawea and Susan B. Anthony, and it always surprises me that they're not larger in circulation. I don't get it. I'm conservative. I have no problem with Harriet being on the 20. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, they ought to start printing larger bills and put her on a $100 or $250 bill or a $500 bill. It's ridiculous, our whole currency situation. And the bigger question, my initial call was to comment on this survey. I have become such a cynic, Evan, that I don't even believe those survey results. I can't believe that the political divide would be that much. Mm. So the bigger question to me is, who in your audience has ever been surveyed for any of these types of things, being duped by all these survey companies anyways, where they do half of a rear-end job of sampling a couple people in a region? It becomes so untrustworthy.
And Tom,
that's
only
all I've got to say, and thank you. Good show.
Thank you, Tom. A couple of points, sir. I absolutely take the point that you want to, if we're going to be using data and evidence, you want it to be solid. Mm-hmm. There are a number of surveys that are out there that indicate we are very divided politically along racial lines about what we think about policy, about what we think about history, about how we want things taught, about how we want things represented. But I do take the point, Tom. I want you to know that I'm listening, and that your experience as a conservative says there's no way you think only a third of conservatives or a third of Republicans would want Harriet Tubman on the 20. And I hope you're right. But my point is, I think that we are pretty divided, and it tends to be more political, even when it feels like it shouldn't. But I will promise you, Tom, as the host of the show, I will try to be very careful with data selection. Benjamin, you want to jump in there?
Go ahead. I think it's also important to remember that we have to understand how these surveys are conducted and what questions are asked and what the buildup is before those questions. But I want to come back to the first thing you mentioned, which is to talk about Sacagawea and Susan B. Anthony on coins that have become collectible, right? So there is an honorific component to the idea that something is collectible. And then we need to also think about currency as tender and legal tender. So I think there was a two very separate ideas. We honor people routinely and honor ideas. We put all 50 states on the quarters. We do these things to sort of honor moments in time, events and people, but they enter into a collectability context and they don't enter into the national narrative. Legal tender becomes part of the national narrative. Look, I'm an American citizen, but I grew up in Australia and we had different women, including the Queen, on our currency all my childhood. And different men and different women, but also flora and fauna and architecture. And if you go around the world, you go to Canada, if you go to Belize, if you go to Brazil, you will find that those countries use the currency to display who they are as a country. And someone coming to the United States is always puzzled by the fact that our bills are all the same size and all the same color. That's odd, first of all. And we don't want to change that, right? We don't want to move to the metric system. It's hard to change a country of more than 300 million. It's a big country to make massive changes like that. So I appreciate that there is sort of resistance to the sort of the general notion of change. But we have to think about what are our emblems telling about us as a country. We need currency that represents all of America and its complexity and in its diversity. I think this should be only the first step towards removing other presidents from the rest of the currency and bringing in other people who have also had powerful contributions to the United States, its history, and its culture.
All right, let's try to get a couple more quick phone calls in. Gail and Henrietta's been waiting. Go ahead, Gail.
I find myself feeling naive about the subject for a completely different reason. I've always known about Harriet Tubman. I'd learned about her in school and the Underground Railroad, and I was shocked to hear that anybody didn't know who she was. Is that because I'm from Rochester? Is she really that unknown outside of
Gail, I think it's less that people know the name, but I don't think they know the fullness of her history. They may know Underground Railroad. They may not know War Hero. They may not know her own life, the risks she took, as her great-great grandniece said today, the physical injury she mm-hmm. suffered, all of the things that she did. So I think that's part of the point is you get a bit of a caricature, you get a little bit of folklore, you don't get a lot of actual sort
right. And they don't know what, we don't know what slavery is. We don't study it in the way that it's part of the national narrative.
Yeah.
In the North, we think of the North as not a slave. New York was a slave-holding state. Connecticut was a slave-holding state. I worked in Connecticut, and it abolished slavery in 1848, right? That was the last time you could be a slave, 1848. People in Connecticut are puzzled when they hear that because they think of their state narrative as this bastion of freedom, but in fact it was the center for the insurance industry, mm-hmm. Hartford, Connecticut, the insurance industry of the slave ships and all slave holdings in the South. Mm-hmm. So we don't talk about the history of slavery as if it's part of the national narrative. And so when Michelle...
It was a business, and it was a business that was very profitable.
Exactly.
Many northern insurance companies, that many northern shippers, that we know it was, you know, this is part of the new narrative that we are understanding mm-hmm. slavery in a fuller way. I would like to comment, though, on the issue of the currency, that also I think it's very fitting because, as Pauline mentioned, Harriet was someone who was viewed as disabled physically. She had been injured. She did suffer from mm-hmm. this intervals of narcoleptic-like losing time. She commented on it, how brave it was. So as a symbol of someone who overcame these enormous disabilities, I think it's so fitting that the Treasury is also going to introduce on this bill for the first time a technique so that people can read the bills, so people who are sight-challenged, mm-hmm. who are unable to see, who are blind, indeed, will be able to read the bills. And I think it's just, you know, the more we learn about this change, the more we should appreciate it and the fullness that is coming out of this Harriet Tubman celebration.
By the way, Maggie Moore Holly, a Harriet Tubman reenactor, since we're down to our final seconds here, where do we get to see you occasionally? I mean, I know you do work where people bring you in, but schools bring you in?
Yes, we go into schools. We go wherever we're invited.
Okay, so what you need to do is you need to get Maggie Moore Holly in. You need to bring her. In fact, Benjamin said, how about RIT?
I think we'll definitely be doing that this year.
Because I just wish we'll just spend a whole separate hour to talk about what it means to be a reenactor. and how you do, how you prepare for your craft. Will you come back and do that someday?
Absolutely.
I would love that, because this hour just vanished. And listeners, we were flooded with commentary. I want to thank both Maggie Moore and Holly, and we're going to see you again. Thank you for being here. Benjamin Lawrence from RIT, great to see you,
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
On the phone with us, Catherine Clinton, the chair of the American History Department at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Catherine, thank you for your insight.
Thank you.
And Geraldine Copes Daniels, the great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. I'm so proud to see her picture come into the 20. Long time coming.
Beautiful.
Thank you for being
here. And I want to say one thing.
You got 10 seconds. Go ahead.
The Harriet Tubman is in New York State, a whole big
we got to go. We'll talk
with you later. Statue of her.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Geraldine. We love you. This was an amazing hour.